Welcome to Self-Compassionate Professor, a career wellness podcast for mid-career and recovering academics who want more. More meaning, balance, rest, joy, and more clarity. Our motto here is no regrets. So glad you're here. Hello, hello. Welcome. This is episode 177, and I'm Danielle Delamar, and I haven't been here for a while. Episode 176 was released in July, so it's been 5 months since I've been here. I took a really, really big break, and I did it because I was starting to hit burnout. And I needed to sort of figure out what I was going to do. And I needed to heal and clarify. And what I came to see is that I needed two things. One, I needed to release podcast episodes less frequently. And right now I'm thinking like once a month, but you know, it might be more often, it might be less often. I'm giving myself sort of the flexibility to release when it feels right. And then the second thing I needed that was going to help me to heal from burnout was more engagement with my listeners. I realized that I really needed more interaction. I needed more engagement. I needed to be more connected. I just was feeling like, you know, I was sort of in this little dark corner of my house, you know, talking to all of you, but not getting any feedback, right? And I did get some, of course. And, you know, thank you to those of you who've sent messages. Thank you to those of you who've rated the podcast, like all of that. Like, yes, I so appreciate it. And I'm not dismissing that at all. But I want more. Like, I want to be able to engage with these topics that come up on the podcast more deeply. And I want to hear what's coming up for you and what's alive for you when you listen to some of these episodes. And when the wisdom that always, and I mean always, flows from each of my guests, I want to know how that wisdom is hitting you and how it's affecting you. And I want to talk about it. And so that's why I have started a Facebook group called Self-Compassionate Professors. I have a fairly small group right now. I think I have like 59, I think is the actual number. And so I would love to have more, and I would love to have you join us. We have had already some really rich conversations, and I want you to join us. Come talk to us. Come be with us. Come help us process in community all the things that come up when we're in a place of, you know, overwork, burnout, when we're in a place of wanting something more and something bigger and better for ourselves and for our careers and feeling sort of stuck. Come join us. Let's talk about it. Let's process together. I would love, love, love to have you. So today on the podcast, I am introducing you to Dr. Cynthia Ganot. And we talk a lot about the body compass and how we can use the body compass to make good career decisions. So you get to hear about that. And I will say this, Cynthia and I just had a conversation in the Facebook group on Facebook Live last week. And so you should make your way over to the Facebook group and hear us talk, because what we talked about is different than what was on the podcast. We actually talked about the power of connection and how connection is very much medicine. And we even danced together. Also, later this month in the Facebook group, I'm going to be doing a mini workshop about how to climb out of the overwork burnout cycle so that you can not only clarify your core career vision, but you can begin actively pursuing it, right? Because so many of us stay stuck in the cycle of overwork burnout, and we can't like figure out how to climb out. So I'm going to talk about that coming up later this month. Yay! Oh, and the other thing I wanted to say is that I'm going to have a free career vision workshop coming up on January 2nd at 12:30 Eastern. And if you're interested, you can find out the details of that workshop in the Facebook group. So again, the Facebook group is called Self-Compassionate Professors, and it is my attempt to connect with you more deeply than I've been able to historically. Okay, that's all I got. I want to introduce you now to Dr. Cynthia Gnote. And by the way, if you want to contact Cynthia, you can email her at cynthia@drcynthiagnote. That's Dr. Cynthia Gnote, GANOTE.com. cynthia@drcynthiagnote.com. And hey, if you join the Facebook group, you could also probably just direct message her. Ooh, I'm so excited. There's so many possibilities for this group. All right, so I'm going to introduce you to the very wise and fun Dr. Cynthia Gnote. Now, here she is. Thank you so much for joining our conversation today. I am so excited to be talking to Dr. Cynthia Gnote, who is a sociology professor and inclusion and belonging expert. Cynthia, how's it going?
Hi, Danielle. I'm doing so well, and I'm delighted to join you.
I am so glad you're here, and we have made it pretty clear that we're just gonna let things roll and see what comes out in our conversation. But we have a lot of rich material to play with. You've had such an interesting career journey. And we have this fun connection. We're both highly sensitive people, and there's this interesting sort of vibe I get with you because of that, I think. I think we both sort of feel this connection on a deeper level, and I don't know. That's the story I'm telling myself. That's at least how I'm feeling, but I'm wondering how you're feeling.
Oh, exactly agreed. I feel like with both of us as highly sensitive people or HSPs, or another way to talk about it is as empaths, it's such an interesting thing having that orientation and having been academics, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't even know how to articulate that in words. There's just like a feeling of like, I don't know, feeling sort of cornered or like stuffed in a box or something. It's yeah, this is my HSP coming out, right? Like I can really feel it in my body, just this sense of like being sort of pushed into a place that doesn't feel quite right to me. I wonder what that is for you.
Oh, so similar to what you describe. And I think about in my early days as a graduate student, I went to grad school in Nashville, Tennessee at Vanderbilt, and I'm a huge lover of live music, and Nashville is the kind of city where no matter what genre you like to listen to, there's world-class live music 7 nights a week, if you have the time to do that. So I was constantly in my early days going to listen to live music, hanging out with friends, hanging out at whatever pubs, wine bars, getting a bite to eat. A friend and I started playing and singing and doing these little shows. He would play, we would both sing. We would do all these different things. And over time, I felt like those interests and so many others got lopped off by feeling like I was shoved into a box. And over time, some probably came off pretty imperceptibly to me. But at this point in my life, I realize how many things I lost that are growing back for me, that I just felt as an academic I wasn't supposed to be expressing, or at least I was supposed to be secret about the fact that I had all these different parts to my life, and it was really uncomfortable.
Wow. That resonates. I wonder, first of all, I want to say, I did not know you sang and played music. Like, I did not know this about you. And how cool is that? I am thinking about, like, some of that work in shamanism around, like, when you sort of miss yourself and you can't find yourself. And shamans will ask, like, okay, well, tell me the moment when you stopped singing and dancing. Like, those are two of the major questions. And so I don't know, it has me curious. When did you stop this singing and playing music?
Oh, you know, I have to really think back to how this happened, because as an early grad student, I was doing all of that. And in the meantime, I met two friends in Nashville, both of whom were indie filmmakers. They both asked me to be in their films. I had not done any real theater to speak of before, besides being a dancer in some different shows as a younger person. And these two different friends would say, okay, so you're going to play this role in this film. And I did it. And so I was in some indie films, and I went to the Sundance Film Festival with my friend, and I did all these different things. And at some point, I can't really explain the middle part, but when I was writing my dissertation, one of my filmmaker friends, he was also in the PhD program with me, and he said to one of our committee members, one of our fellow favorite faculty members, and she was on both of our dissertation committees, and he said something about telling her I was in the film. And I had this serious talk with him about, okay, please don't mention that to her again, because I'm really keeping that secret that I have other interests and things that I do. And he just looked at me really puzzled, because he was doing the PhD in a really different way. And I was at that point where I just wanted to be finished. And it wasn't about this one particular person. It was about the institution. I felt the pressure of that wouldn't be serious. I wouldn't be a serious academic if I were doing these indie films and, you know, being in costume with crazy makeup and, you know, just playing these different roles and playing and singing and all these different things. And so I really internalized that pressure that parts of me could not belong in this academic path that I was pursuing.
Okay. And so at what point did you let the filmmaking and the singing and all that artistic stuff go? Did you?
I did. It was when I got my tenure track job. I moved out to the Bay Area, which is actually an amazing place for all those things, music and theater and film and, you know, all those things. And I thought, gosh, I will still retain doing these things, but I'll just be, you know, I thought it would be a little bit of a don't ask, don't tell situation. That's how I'd been performing it in grad school. And instead, I got to this job and it took all of me. I mean, all of me and then some. I was so drained. I felt so overburdened with service work. I felt so connected with my students and wanted to really be there for them, and started doing a lot of care work within academia and all the different things. There were more things to do and more hoops to jump through on the tenure track than I had as a as a body, you know, the actual time mm-hmm. to do, but I did it anyway and knocked it out of the park. And it was much to my own expense, to the expense of my own health in body, mind, and spirit. And it, I realized not only did I not have any time to do those other things, I didn't, I mean, my recovery time would be spent lying on the couch like, you know, like a couch potato, because I didn't really, I didn't have any life spirit left for film or dance or music or much of anything, except I'd try to cram in going to hear a live show every once in a while. Mm.
Okay, so right now I'm just imagining, and you tell me where I'm wrong, but I'm imagining this like spiral where you just, where things sort of close off more and more. Is that how you experienced it, or was it a different experience?
It was a horrible experience, to be perfectly honest. It was one where I'd moved 2,400 miles away from my family. I moved by myself. I thought, like every other place I'd ever moved, I would, you know, just find my community immediately once I got there, because I have never had trouble finding my people wherever I went in the world. And I've never in my life found anywhere so hard as this institution. Maybe it was the part of the Bay that I was in. I lived at the time in North Berkeley, but the institution was out in the burbs through a tunnel and out in the suburbs. And it was really unbelievably hard to meet my people. So I was really lonely, and I was working constantly, and my interests were like tentacles being cut off. And yet I was supposedly in, you know, I'm in a tenure track job, and I'm in the Bay Area in a tenure track job. These things were supposed to be unbelievably desirable, and I was pretty miserable.
Ooh. When did you admit that all to yourself? I know that sometimes takes time.
I early on would have different, I found a work confidant pretty early on to whom I said, these things are happening to me. It was extreme instances of sexism. And I would talk to her about it, and she would go, yep, I hear you. And, you know, I honor what you're saying. And do you want to talk to this other person about it, like a senior colleague? And at the time, I was really telling the truth about it, but you know, it was this brand new person, brand new in this role, brand new to the region, brand new to everything. I'd visited there before, but I hadn't lived there. And so I would just tell this one confidant with this kind of startled look on my face. And so I was really honest with myself about it, but thought maybe it'll get better when, you know, when they realize. I had this really clear strategy of, let me show them, you know, whether it's my department, this great books program I was asked to teach in immediately, the January term program I was asked to teach in immediately. Let me show them who I am. Let me show them the quality of my work, and then maybe it'll be easier, or then maybe they'll trust me, or then maybe fill in the blank. And so I kind of put it out in front of myself. If I do all these things, you know, we got PhDs. We're people who can really put those delayed gratifications out there. But it didn't get easier. It was always easy with my students. It was always easy with a number of staff members. It was always easy with a very small handful of faculty at first, but that I got to know more over time and met wonderful people, of course, there. But things got more brutal in different, more complex ways as time went on. And I also have to say, if I may add this, I think I also became known as kind of shiny. Like I got lots of accolades. I got lots of accolades. I was getting all kinds of positive strokes, both in, students were lining up for my classes and I had huge wait lists and I would get invited to do all kinds of talks and all kinds of represent the university at this and that place with the alumni and do all this. And people would say, wonderful, oh, I've heard all about you and blah, blah, blah. I just was unbelievably miserable if I wasn't in my classroom with my students. I was never miserable when I was in my classroom with my students.
Okay. So that has me wondering what the difference was between being in class with your students and then doing all the other stuff.
Here's what I can express. When I was in the classroom with my students, I would set up a container where my whole goal was that everyone was included and everyone could belong. And I would create this kind of thing at the beginning of class where I would say, as so many of us do, we talk about different kinds of community agreements. Mine were all about, you know, the respect and dignity of each person in the class is the most important thing. And we're going to be talking about race, class, and gender inequalities in my sociology classroom. And we're going to be talking about all kinds of contemporary social problems and political spectrums and all these kinds of things that many people consider really controversial. But that's what our daily conversations and readings and everything else are going to be about. So what we can do with each other is come to some agreements. There is no reason ever for any kind of name calling or casting aspersions on anyone's character, but we can disagree with each other and should and will and are going to all the time. When we do so, you know, saying to someone, oh, I really hear your perspective. You know, I actually see it pretty differently. And then sharing that. Often asking students to call each other by name. I would always try to call my students by name, learn their names, try to call them by name, let them know their voices were included, and really both tell them, but then model for them how it is that we talk to each other in a really diverse world where we don't see things in the same way. And that's great, good, fine, wonderful, even. We're going to learn something from each other. But there's no need to grind each other down or call names. And so I would just set the rules for engagement in my own classroom. And students would very early on, after seeing this modeled, or perhaps they came in with these skill sets, some of them, they would just really take that ball and run with it. And then when we were in different kind of collective faculty meetings, you know, faculty governance meetings or different spaces, those same agreements just weren't shared. And I found a really, really patriarchal, both culture and structures. And so I was a young woman starting in that job in the most patriarchal place I'd ever been or worked in my life, trying to navigate all that while I was creating this other thing with my students. So the contrast just could not have been more different.
I see. Okay. So, you know me, I always want to ask about how you feel it in your body. And I know you have a piece that just came out in a book about faculty burnout, and you talk a lot about the feelings in your body. And I guess I'm wondering, what's the difference between being sort of in those patriarchal spaces, faculty governance meetings and other places? Like, what was the feeling in your body in those places versus when you were in your classroom and you could create that sort of that really inclusive container that supported everyone? Like, yeah, how did that feel in your body in each of those places?
So let me go with the faculty governance kind of spaces first. In this, and let me of course say where there were some wonderful people in each of those spaces, zero doubt. It just was an overall culture that was extremely patriarchal. And when I was in one of those deeply patriarchal spaces, I would feel my stomach start to just feel like it was churning. Then it would feel like it was going into knots. And it would, like, my gut will be the absolute first thing to respond. It might go so far that I start to feel nauseous. It might go so far that I, think I've got to take something, a medication or a pain reliever or something for this. So that's the first thing. The second thing is underneath my hair, I have long dark hair. Underneath my hair, I started to realize over time at my last institution, I would get cold sweat when I was walking into one of those collective spaces. So the cold sweat under the hair is a really disgusting feeling. When I would feel the guts first, when it would go to hair, I'm like, oh, I mean, it's roll bad. And so that would be that's my body compass for when it's bad and not a space that is right for my own thriving. Now, on the other end, I'd walk into my own classroom. I would just have this really open, spacious feeling, like my gut would feel unclenched, open, unburdened, let's say. My throat would feel open. And my energy running through my body would be big. So it just would feel like I was unencumbered and that everything could flow. And my students in those, I was at this institution for 10 years. Oh my gosh, my students in all along in those 10 years were just gorgeous partners in dialogue and co-creating new knowledge around race, class, gender, and then later sexualities, because my own students said, we want that piece added in, queer theory and all the rest. And so I learned those literatures and added those in. And it was always a co-creation with my students. And so that just felt expansive and generative and beautiful.
Okay. So I guess, first of all, I can feel your description of being in your class, and I can also feel the previous description in my body. And I'm wondering, sort of, I know that you eventually left, and you know your body compass was eventually telling you, or maybe it was telling you much sooner than you were willing to admit, but it was telling you to get out. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what sort of happened. Like, is it that what you were feeling in the classroom was just not enough to balance out the pain of the other parts of your work? Like, how did that happen? How did you know you needed to leave?
Yeah, you know, I was getting those signals much earlier than when I left. I will say that the signals came, I'm sure, multiple years before I actually left. And they were getting bigger. They were getting more severe. And at one point, I had a really good female colleague who we were having a coffee, and she said, "May I big sister you for a moment?" I said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. And she said, "I want to say the following." She attributes three diseases to her work at this institution. And she said that she saw so much of herself in me. But at that time, I was at a younger, you know, at a younger phase in my career. And she said, "Please don't keep working at this level until you get sick. It will make you sick." And I could already feel that coming on. And I knew in my body, I knew 100% she was absolutely right. And I knew in that moment I had been receiving these messages and they were getting bigger and getting more problematic. I was having more health issues and headaches and all kinds of things. My body wasn't able to keep withstanding that pace in an environment that I at some point started to find to be very toxic. It just wasn't, my body couldn't withstand that for a sustained amount of time. And so I went on sabbatical and I had a real pause with myself. And I came back and I had really different boundaries afterwards. And one of my really good friends said, "You came back from sabbatical and you're acting more like a man." And she said, the way she meant that was, I would say, "No, when I was asked to do something and I really felt that I couldn't healthily do it." And I would say yes to things I felt I could wholeheartedly do. And she was right. I had really moved my boundaries, but I received incredible pushback when I started saying no to things that, you know, I was known before. "Oh my gosh, she's so helpful. I was helping with everything." And, you know, I just had a big kind of moment with myself over sabbatical and came back with really different, healthier boundaries. That was not met with surprise and delight. I had one person actually ask me three times about something I said no to. And I kept thinking, has he forgotten? What is going on? You know, I would say no, as we had talked about before. I cannot, ba-da-da-da-da. And then he'd just come back with it. And I realized,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, he was being passive aggressive. He later told me how angry he was with me. I mean, he really let loose on me later, but it first started out as just repeat requests I'd already said no to. And so things really changed after I got back from sabbatical and grew some new boundaries.
So was this pushback the thing that drove you out? Because I know now you're at a different university. Like what was it that drove you out? Was it that the strength of that pushback or something else?
Not quite yet. I mean, that was awful. And I was having this, oh my gosh. I mean, there's a lot of research that actually suggests that I've read after that experience that suggests that women who say no. So when women are just told in academia, just say no, women who say no receive much different consequences often, rather than in general, in big, broad sweeps, men who say no are often taken for, you know, that, well, I understand that you've said no. Okay. But so much of the academic care work falls to women. Of course, there are exceptional men. Of course, non-binary folks certainly are included in those who are doing so much of the service. But those who are expected to do a lot of academic service, when they say no, there's really different kinds of consequences. So I know that now. Mm. That started to really feel deeply problematic. I realized at one point I was working on an equity mindset of, oh, I'm doing all these things. I've been elected to these campus-wide committees. I kept getting elected to things. And we all had to put up our names for election each time. I kept getting elected. And while that at first was really flattering and really an honor and I wanted to do it, over time I realized there are some people that end up doing all the service and all the leadership. And that was a whole conglomeration of women, men, and non-binary folks in that category. And then there were others who just, I mean, never had to lift a service finger because nobody elected them to be on things because they were not pleasant to be on things with. And and so that's the, you know, no good deed goes unpunished kind of thing on the end of anybody who gets asked to do a lot of service. So I started to get this idea of, well, I'm doing all this other stuff. At least that will be, you know, seen as important contributions. And that was not for, you know, just certain folks that were evaluating my promotion tenure case, those kinds of things. I'd already gotten tenure at this point, actually. So it was just promotion of full. So there were just some different pressures I was receiving, but that still wasn't enough for me to leave. What happened in the end was I was sexually harassed. I'm a race, class, and gender sociologist. I immediately took it to, yeah, that's the wrong. I mean, you know, obviously, everyone is the wrong person to harass. And so I mean it in the following way. You harass the wrong person. I'm reporting it, you know, meaning I'm not going to be silent and you can't frighten me into anything. And so I went to HR and Title IX and I reported it at the bias incident response team for good measure and thought, look, I mean, this is a known, I learned it was a known, harasser amongst women on campus who would ask me. I was not saying the person's name at all because I was putting it through the process. And one high up administrator came up to me at one point and said, I know you're not talking. I know you're not saying anything because of the process, but I'm going to guess. I'm going to say one name. And she said that name. She knew. Do you know what I mean? So this was one of those, like, this was a known suspect kind of thing. And I put it all the way through and I lost that. The man was found not to be guilty of sexual harassment because he said he didn't do it. And they called it a he said, she said. And they didn't do a character. I basically said, you are most welcome to ask any random person walking out the door if I'm someone who tells the truth. Am I someone with integrity? And the person in HR said, oh, no, we don't do that at all. It's just, you know, he said, she said. And so this person went on to not only, you know, wasn't found guilty of sexual harassment, but was then put in the university promo, like in different newsletters and things like that. Wow. Was highlighted about three big times within the next few months. And I'm going to have to be careful about how I tell these details, but I basically said to the HR person, you need to remove our undergraduate students from this person's riding in this person's car. This person was known to drive people in his car a lot. And to a specific kind of event. And I said, you need to remove them that from his duties immediately. I'm not happy with this finding, but you know, you need to put other undergraduates, get them out of this situation. And they said, we can't, we are not going to, we will not. And so what I knew then was I'd given a decade of my life, blood, sweat, tears, gave more than I had to give, much to my own detriment, and that there was nothing there to support me or anybody, especially not in the face of a powerful man. And nobody cared if I told the truth, didn't, you know, what anybody's kind of 10-year reputation or, you know, record of work was or anything else. And so that is what finally sent me to say I went on an unpaid leave. I didn't want to have to pay them back anything because I couldn't bring myself to quit my tenured job, but I also couldn't make my body return there. And so I went on an unpaid leave, no health insurance, no, you know, no pay, no health insurance. And that is what, you know, after sitting with that for a time, that is finally what sent me out of academia, I thought, you know, entirely of academia. And then I ended up actually coming home to Louisville, Kentucky. I started at my hometown institution, University of Louisville, dipped my toe in teaching one class, and then something came up full time, and then I became an assistant dean and those kinds of things. But I thought I was leaving academia for good and was ready to leave academia for good.
Okay. And what do I want to know? I have these things swirling in my head because I know parts of your story. And so I guess the question I have right now is you did the administrative work and now you're in a faculty position and you're also doing some consultancy work. And I want to know sort of what has felt best, what has your body compass told you over the course of all of these sort of pivots? And where are you heading at this point based on sort of that information, based on, you know, the journey of just listening and making the sort of right step at the right time kind of thing?
So I learned to listen to my body through that experience at my previous institution. I was not at first wanting to know what my body was telling me. I was not trying to hear that information. I was just trying to get tenure. But my body was giving me plenty of information all the way along. The signals got louder. And by the end, they were just blaring. And I finally got it and I got out. Now, over time, I have come to now absolutely rely on my body's signals. I know they tell me the truth. I trust my body. I trust myself. I trust my inner sense of knowing. So now I'm at a really different place. Now, with my consulting business, I do a lot of work with organizations who want to increase their culture of inclusion and belonging. And one of the things that I think about when I do this work is every single time I give an educational workshop or a keynote speech, or I talk with one of the leaders in an organization. I feel so expansive. I'm so excited. My energy is built by that. I have something that I've been honing for 25 years because I've taught about race, class, and gender inequalities in the sociology classroom for 25 years now. And I've honed this way of, as a sociologist, I can really analyze the structure and the culture of a place. And for places that are serious about doing the inclusion and belonging work, I'm in. I have something to bring. I'm so excited. So I love that work. And it continues to feel really expansive in my body. If there is a point where I did meet with one potential client over Zoom and I just had a really, let's say, yucky body feeling about it. And I just ended up saying, you know, I don't think I'm the right consultant for you, but I'd like to recommend some other possibilities, some other folks. And so now I really rely on the body compass and messages from my body to learn even things like, wow, this looks amazing. If I'm feeling a really weird feeling in my stomach, I'll spend some time with that and meditate and go, you know, what is my body telling me? What is this message? So I've really spent a lot of time learning how to translate. When before I was trying to just shove it down and be like, get in line, we're going to get tenure. We got this job in the Bay Area. Please cooperate. And my body was not cooperating, Danielle. Because it was not a match for me. And it was in fact a very toxic situation. So when it comes to my work now, it's incredibly emergent. As new jobs come up in my business, I interact with the person, you know, tell me why you're calling me. What might I be able to offer? How can we co-create something moving forward that would really help your organization or your team or your leaders? And it's just so exciting. I love it so much when folks who want the work and they want something I have to give, and I am so happy to give it, and it feels meaningful to me. That is what's life-giving for me at the moment.
Whew. Okay, so what I'm feeling right now is this story and something you've said to me previously, which is, I'm just working on listening to my body moment to moment. My body always knows. I just go with that. That's what I'm practicing. And so that to me feels so grounding, so easy, and not easy, but so simple in that all I have to do is pause, notice what I need, and go in that direction. Notice where the expansive energy is going and go in that direction. And that's a hard lesson to learn. The trust thing is a hard lesson to learn. And so I'm wondering what your sort of advice to people who may want to also develop this skill is. Like, what would you say they start with?
Oh, I love it. What a great question. Because you don't have to have such a hard lesson as I did to be sexually harassed, right? I mean, mine was it was a conk on the head, right? You don't have to go through all of that. If you start... here's one thing. I think, Danielle, you were also trained as a coach by Martha Beck. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
I also was I counted it up. I think it was 18 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Can you believe? And so when Martha taught me, us, the body compass. That's, to me, a great place to start. So I don't know if you would describe it any differently from this, but just for listeners, the body compass is when you you kind of calibrate in your own internal body by, usually through guided meditation, going in your mind to a terrible experience, what, you know, one that's manageable in your head that won't send you into PTSD, you know, but a bad experience and that you think of and you notice in your body, what do I feel? You know, for me, it's going to be that clenched gut. It's going to be, you know, certain things for me. It's often going to be an adjoining headache, a little side of headache. It's going to be, you know, whatever it is for me, and for somebody else, it's going to be something else. But you kind of notice your own, here's the bad feeling on one end of the continuum. And then you go to, okay, now think of a wonderful experience or day or time in your life or person. And then you take a breath in between those two, but then you go into that beautiful experience and you notice, what does that feel like in my body? And you kind of journal about that, and that becomes your calibration for body compass. And then I end up with coaching clients. I also do coaching with my consulting business. I end up with coaching clients in a kind of, when you think of this possibility, you're looking at different possibilities or different ways forward. Why don't you sit with this one for a bit and see how it feels in your body? And at whatever point, cleanse the palate, go to the other one and see how it feels in your body. And you can just start to do those sorts of exercises. And that's just one tool, the body compass, but you can also be checking in.
And let me just say really quick, mm-hmm. for listeners who are interested in this, I have a little body compass calibration meditation, which does exactly what you just described on the free resources on my website. So you could go there to calibrate if you have to make a decision about something. So sorry, go ahead.
Oh, Danielle, so perfect. Y'all go to that. I'm telling you, that was my starting point. It really was. I actually, if you can believe it, learned body compass before all this terrible experience. But I was not trying to hear what my body was saying during the whole period when I was just trying to get tenure. And so I am back to recommending to people the body compass, doing it myself, and Danielle just doing every practice I can that's about, oh, I just felt a really weird thing in my body. What was just said? You know, I'll kind of be like, what did I just hear? You know, is the news on? Am I talking to somebody? What was that? I'll try to do these micro moments of translation, really, of the information my body is giving me. And then it becomes an ongoing practice that I come back to all the time.
And I will say this too. For some of us, it's easier than for others. I think the highly sensitive person piece makes it a little easier for us. I'm not saying like if you're not an HSP, you're not going to get it. Like that's not what I'm saying at all. But I do think it is a little more natural for some of us, and takes a little more practice for others. I don't know. What would you say?
No, I think you're right. You know, I was talking to one of my dearest friends, a friend who's like family, this past weekend, and she said somehow we were talking about something else, and she was saying the first time that someone asked her, what do you feel in your body? She was like, wait, do people feel things in their bodies? No. And that brought a lot of information to me. And, you know, and she talked about her kind of trying to tune in and realizing how much, because of her past experiences, she had really detached from her body, which I really understand. And let me say, I'm sure there are other industries, but academia in particular, I feel like we're treated like disembodied heads. And I started to treat myself like that. I had internalized that so deeply. So I get it. If the body thing does not seem natural at first, I would say try that body compass calibration, try some other check-ins, some of your other check-ins of how am I feeling? What do I need right now? And I'm sure you can point people towards your own resources with that. But it, even dipping a toe into, am I having a kind of weird feeling about this? I think can really help the practice and can turn up the volume on what your body's actually trying to tell you.
Amen. Amen. I love it. Okay. So I want to ask you what you need to make sure you say before we end this delightful conversation. I think it has offered so much sort of richness and insight and new ways of perceiving, especially for people who haven't thought about the body compass before. So there's that. But what do you want to end with to make sure we say to make the conversation feel complete to you? And I'll ask you about your services in a minute, yes, but I want to know more about like the conversation.
Yeah. So I had this image the other day. I do a lot of guided imagery, guided meditations. I had this image come to me of a ball of light. And when I am trying to follow the standards of an industry, of course, for us, you know, it's been academia and getting tenure and all those standards, all the things that were not set by me and that ended up rewarding things that were not necessarily what I thought was the most important or meaningful part of my work. I saw this ball of light that I was chasing in my mind. And I, you know, it was just always out in front of me. I was kind of running towards it. But then I moved the ball of light inside of me and felt this sense of if I belong to myself internally, so internal belonging, if I am being 100% authentic to myself, if I am saying no to things that are just absolute deal breakers for me, which of course I did in different stages at my past job, but in the end, you know, really said that I can't be a part of this. I had tenure, I was about to get full professor, and said, I can not be a part of this anymore, and walked. And so when I belong to myself, even if the rewards of that other thing seem really desirable or have been painted by the society as really desirable, I cannot tell you the kind of liberation that has come to me from following the internal sense of belonging. So one thing that came to me as I had realized there was no way I could stay, though I was in a tenured position, I was about to get full professor, but that this was a hostile environment for me and for many, but that what I could say was I couldn't stay under these conditions. So a colleague came to me, very feminist colleague came to me and said she completely understood. I was anguished about the decision, but said, you know, I just don't see any other way. I've taken this to the mat and I lost in a blaze of glory. I left it all on the field and I lost real big by taking all that to HR and Title IX and all of it. And now I can't unsee that I am not protected. You are not protected. None of us are protected in any way. And she said, I hear you. I get that. But what about the students? I mean, do you consider staying for the students? Because what on earth are they going to do without you? And I felt like that was a what about the children kind of argument? Set women who are in either emotionally abusive relationships or, you know, this kind of thing. And I kind of couldn't believe my ears, but I said, you know, I love the students here so much. I know you know that. And my staying is going to destroy me, and I can't let that happen. And so I know that there will be other caring faculty members for our students. And I often stay in touch with my former students. Those relationships remain, but I gotta go. And the reason I tell that story is, if there's anybody out there who's hearing a, "But what about the students? You're the only one." That's really not fair. And the one thing I knew I was the steward of was my own life spirit, and I couldn't allow it to get snuffed out there or to get sick. Now, coda to that is 2 years later, I came back once I had fully resigned. I'd taken an unpaid leave, but I had 2 years later fully resigned and went to graduation of a student of mine there, same institution. And another student was with my student, and she said, "Oh my gosh, you're Professor Ganote. Oh, I have heard all about you. Oh my gosh, I've been wanting to meet you." And she said, "When you quit, when you were harassed, you have no idea what that did for me. Just to let me know, in the future, I don't have to stick around for something that is abusive. I don't have to stick around for something that's harming me or making me sick." She's like, "You don't even know what you've done for me. Thank you." And my chin just about hit the ground. I'd never thought of it that way, Danielle, but it meant more than I could say that, you know, while I had been held to, that wasn't the only time it had happened that somebody said to me, "But what about the students?" Because they knew I really cared about students. They knew I had been perceived as a very effective teacher and all those kinds of things. I just had to value myself more than being willing to stay in an abusive situation.
Mm. Okay, Cynthia, tell us how we can reach you if we are interested in we're interested in your work. We are committed to creating a culture of belonging in our organization, or we as individuals want to create a sense of internal belonging. How do we get a hold of you?
Thank you for asking, Danielle. I am on both LinkedIn and Instagram as Cynthia Ganote. I am about to launch my Dr. Cynthia Ganote website. I really, really love working with both organizations who want to pursue a greater culture of belonging, and then any individuals who are interested in this idea of belonging to, of internal belonging, folks who want to discuss those things, want to get in touch in any way, are so welcome. I would just love those conversations.
Thanks for listening to Self-Compassionate Professor. Join us in the Self-Compassionate Professors Facebook group and let us know how this episode landed for you. Also, is the sabbatical program right for you? It's my year-long group coaching program to end the academic overwork burnout cycle and uncover the core career vision beneath. Check it out at selfcompassionateprofessor.com. Don't forget the .com. Take care.